Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left Restaurant in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach through restaurantguysradio.com, or you can download our podcast from iTunes.
iTunes or Podcast Alley or any of those cool podcasting sites. If you don't know how to podcast and you'd like to be sure you catch all of our shows, you can visit the website, and we've got instructions there on how to do it and make sure that our show gets delivered to your computer every time we put one up. And we put one up on the web a lot. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm full of pep.
Yeah, that's because you weren't the one who stayed late to make sure the ceiling went well last night. I want to share with people, we're building this new restaurant, right? Mm-hmm. It's going to open in about 2 weeks. And it's incredible. It's just incredible the amount of work that there is. Running a restaurant, that's a lot of work. Building a restaurant, we spent close to $2 million on this place, mm-hmm. right? And do you know what we just spent about $10,000 doing? Getting the color of the ceiling wrong.
Yes.
We're like, we put up the, because we have 5,000 square feet of ceiling. And, you know, being a restaurateur is a, I'm doing plumbing and HVAC,
right.
And then I'm cleaning up the basement, and then I got to pick a color on the ceiling. It's amazing, because if you paint a little corner and you're like, that looks good, and then you paint 5,000 square feet of it,
it doesn't look so good.
Oh, my God. The green we picked was what Linda Blair, the color of what Linda Blair spit at the priest in The Exorcist when her head spun around.
There are some things about being a restaurant owner that people don't realize. One is you have to be a designer. You have to be an engineer in order to get these things correct.
You know, it's funny.
And sometimes you don't.
I will tell you what's funny. Because we're picking the paint. We're like two, mm-hmm. three guys own a restaurant. Mark and I and our partner Lou, who's a wonderful guy. What people have said of our restaurant is it's a little masculine. You know? Because we're guys. We have a friend of ours who's a little flamboyant and from New York and who had come into the restaurant for the first time, who said to me, and I'll always remember, I said, well, what do you think? And he said, well, not bad for a couple of straight boys from New Jersey. And I took that as a great compliment. Anyway, ceiling's brown, everybody. Straight guys picked the color. I just couldn't come up with a color, so it's brown.
The place turned out great. But mm-hmm. That's
masculine.
It's because it took us three tries.
It's fireplaces, and there's red on the walls. It's a bunch of guys. But at least it's going to be better than the review that was in Wednesday's New York Times by Frank Bruni, which we reported on this show as soon as it opened, chuckling about it.
This was a tough review, man. This is tough. I got to tell you, this is a tough review.
And it seems all well-deserved. There was a restaurant that opened in New York just recently, which is, it's a ninja restaurant.
It's called Ninja New York.
And the idea is it's a theme restaurant. Let me read from the review. We've read from some other reviews, and I'm dying to go there, and I want to get there soon.
You better.
Because it's going to close. Let me tell you, this review, it got a poor.
A poor, by the way, for everyone who doesn't quite understand the star system for the New York Times, a poor would be the equivalent of negative one star.
Right. It goes poor, satisfactory, 1, 2, 3, 4 stars. Poor is like you're in the negative numbers.
So in your next review, you got to get one star.
To break
just
even.
Just to be back to the restaurant you didn't open.
And, you know, they don't really give these out very often, but this sounds so stupid. Let's read a little from the review.
You
should really go online, pick up the Times.
Very fun.
The point of a restaurant with the mission of a Saturday Night Live skit, Ninja New York, deposits you in a kooky, dreary subterranean labyrinth that seems better suited to coal mining than supping. You're greeted there by servers in black costumes who ceaselessly bow, regularly yelp, and ever so occasionally tumble. Oh, my God. You're asked to choose between two routes to your table. The first is described by the ninja escort as simple and direct. The second is dark, dangerous, and narrow, involving a long tunnel, a drawbridge that descends only when your escort ninja intones a special command, which he later implores you to keep secret.
And I'll have you know, Frank Bruni, being the consummate professional, keeps that secret.
Frank Bruni says, I recommend the third path right out the back door. This is a $3.5 million design budget.
Ouch.
That gorges, fake torches, fake all sorts of stuff.
What are they thinking?
Okay. And check this out. And here's the thing. Like, there's Mars 2112. Mm-hmm. There are a bunch of, like, theme restaurants for your 13-year-old daughter
and
to go to.
And it's fine. If you want to go to a Disney ride restaurant, absolutely go for it.
Check this out. If you leave out the back door, you will be spared an infinitely larger measure of tedium, visual histrionic smorgasbord of undistinguished food, and a discordant bill that easily exceeds $100 a person.
$100 a person.
For the ninja restaurant.
Okay. Let me explain something to you. Fly down to Disney for the day.
Look.
Go Mark, on a ride.
Mark and I have spent...
Come home.
We spent thousands on food.
Skip the ninja restaurant.
But this is just stupid. On my first visit, when I tried the $150 tasting menu with a dearth of culinary highlights, but a surfeit of ninja pageantry... Yeah, that's not a good review right there.
Oh, and some of the food that they talk about here. Okay, this I have to read. It trots out a golden tower roll, which inexplicably embeds uni, which is sea urchins, in a sponge cake and a spring snow roll, which engulfs eel in an obliterating puck of sweetened cream cheese.
Oh, my God.
Eel and sweetened cream cheese. Mmm.
Here's some more histrionics. Are you ready? The service, and we're talking about...
I'm sorry. Eel and sweetened cream cheese.
It's like peanut butter and jelly in Japan.
Sounds like the breakfast of champions.
Exactly, champion sumo wrestlers. Ninja New York is the restaurant we're talking about. Got a negative one-star review in the New York Times. Very, very hard to do. I bet they spent $7 million, $10 million on this restaurant. $7 million.
Okay, what the New York Times is saying is... Better that they left this place vacant. Okay? It's better to actually go to dinner in an empty building.
Here's another concept thing. In the service of tableside derring do, the restaurant spotlights what it calls meteorite pot, a milky brew with Thai seasonings and slices of pork loin. A ninja cooks it close in sizzling proximity to diners by having a large hot by heaving a large hot rock into the broth. This makes the room. This is a soup. And a sauna.
I read that book, Rock Soup. I read it.
It's a soup and a sauna, not to mention a pointless effort for the thin, dull outcome. Tasting menus range from $80 to $200 a person. Are you kidding me?
$200.
If a restaurant wants to charge between $12 and $18 for a glass of white wine and $15 for a week's specialty drinks, it should respond to an expressed interest in sake with the presentation of the sake list, not with, I'll bring you a half liter. Yeah. A fatty tuna steak available a la carte for $45 was no larger than a cutlet. While I expected O Toro, the highest grade of tuna, which for $45 an entree you would expect, while I expected O Toro, I detected no Toro. Man.
Here you go. Okay. You want to have a theme restaurant. You want to have a fun place to take the kids. You know, I think Francis and I don't really have a huge problem with that.
Not at all.
You know, it's a fun night out, whatever. Go do your event at Mars 21 or wherever you happen to be going.
2112. Get it right.
2112, right.
The shoddy service also contradicted the cost. If a restaurant wants to promote a 6 multi-course meals that range from $80 to $200, it should make sure that the menu on which these options appear doesn't have a big red food stain on it like my companions did.
$200 person, I have to get a clean menu. And my server can't tumble.
I don't need to go over any secret bridges. And they recommend this restaurant finally then for a toddler with a trust fund and a yen for udon and maki. Get the double entendre there. A yen for udon and maki. Ninja might be a valid alternative to Jekyll and Hyde, where you can get hamburgers. For just about anybody else, it's nonsensical, and its climactic illusion may well be a disappearing act. We believe so. If you want to go to this restaurant, we suggest you hurry.
Go quickly.
And
run.
You know
Mark Don't
and I,
walk.
And Mark and I are going to try and go and bring a microphone and before it closes. It's... Ninja New York, 25 Hudson Street, New York City. We'll put the link up to our website before it closes. Why don't you try it out?
When it closes, we'll take the website off.
After the break, we have the preeminent American bartender, Dale DeGroff, who's going to join us to talk about cocktails in New York and in Russia and around the world, and also the Museum of the American Cocktail in New Orleans. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15.
Morgan Funding.
Central Jersey Talk Radio. Central Jersey 1450. WCTC with the Restaurant Guys.
Hey, you're back with the Restaurant Guys. Mark Pascal and Francis Schott from Stage Left Restaurant, and in a couple of weeks, Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in downtown New Brunswick. And we have with us a special guest today. He's our old friend Dale DeGroff. Dale is author of the book The Craft of the Cocktail. He sort of is the preeminent bartender. Well, he is the preeminent bartender in America. Dale, welcome to the show.
Dale, my friend, how are you doing today?
Hi, Francis.
How's everything?
I'm fine.
Thanks for joining us to talk about cocktails. Many people don't realize, we had you on the show last time, and we talked about the imminent Museum of the American Cocktail, which has since opened, and it opened in New Orleans. And
yes,
will you tell us about the opening and about what's happened with the Museum of the American Cocktail now?
Well, since I talked to you and Mark last time, a lot has happened, and most importantly, of course, was the storm. We had a wonderful 9-month run until that moment. We had tremendous reception from the community down there, the restaurant community especially. The Brennan family were extraordinary, Lally Brennan and T. Adelaide Martin, and they continue to be generous because they've invited us to Las Vegas to Commander's Palace, where they have a nice big room where we can install the exhibit.
Oh, that's
great.
What
we intend to do, yeah.
Why don't you tell us what the Museum of the American Cocktail was all about and how it came to be?
It came to be over a discussion that Jill and I had.
Jill is your wife?
Yes, my wife, Jill. Jill, we've talked about this over the years, and basically last year Jill said, let's just do it. And we called Anastasia Miller and Jared Brown, two really dear friends and authors and cocktail geeks like us, and and they said, yeah, wow, we're there. And then we called other friends who we thought would be interested, Robert Hess, who created Drink Boy, which is probably the ultimate bartender's chat room worldwide. I say that without any reservation.
Right.
I think any bartender worth his salt, any owner, any journalist who writes about the bar business has to be on Drink Boy daily.
And we'll make sure that we put that up on our website so you guys can link to that.
He's a Microsoft executive, so he helped us build our website. We had our legal problems handled by a descendant of Antoine Peychaud named Philip Green, who happens to be a trademark and patent lawyer in Washington, D.C.
Just so everybody knows, Peychaud is a famous bitters and cocktail mixer.
Peychaud's bitters, absolutely very
important.
It
should be more well-known than it is, but it's not. I'd like to see it in bars all over America so that I could have my Sazerac no matter where I went, which is the famous cocktail, of course.
We're doing our best to spread the word, Dale.
So now you got all these famous people together, and what goes in the Museum of the American?
I forgot to mention our curator.
Oh, okay.
Dr. Cocktail, Ted Hay, who curated the first show and our second show in New York. We are opening in New York on 28th Street at Talents. Our second curator will be David Wondrich, who's a columnist for Esquire magazine and author. And
Madam fabulous cocktail expert.
Terrific.
We're looking forward to a January opening on 28th Street at Balance, where we will have our own floor, hopefully for the next 5 years or so. We continue to do our mixology seminars in Washington, D.C., Las Vegas, San Francisco, Seattle, and New York. And we have two coming up, one on November 8th here in town at Dillon Prime. Champagne cocktails, which myself and Jared Brown and Anastasia will host.
How does somebody sign up for those, and why don't you tell us a little bit more about the cocktail seminars?
That's easy. Just go to www.museumoftheamericancocktail.org.
And again, we'll put that link up through our site so nobody has to remember.
Now, these seminars, are there instructions on how to make cocktails, or there are discussions about the history of the cocktail? What goes on in these?
They're dependent on the moderator. For example, the last New York seminar with Anastasia and Jared was more presentational. They talked about the history of the particular gin drinks they were making and passed out the ingredients. But people did have, there was a little bit of interactive. The one before that was completely interactive when George Delgado did a cocktail seminar the way he and I used to present at Windows in the World, where the guests actually make their own cocktails,
right,
which is great fun. So it's really up to the moderator. The one that I'll be doing, champagne, will be partly interactive because I'm going to teach everybody how to make a pitcher of Bellini.
Ah, terrific. You did a great cocktail seminar for Stage Left for our bartenders when we first opened, Dale, where you taught people the theory of making cocktails and as well showed them how to make cocktails and was indeed interactive, and they got into it and made some of their own cocktails. Are you doing a lot of that anymore? Or is that
I do it. That's how I make my living. I have a contract at a hotel in Hawaii, which is just terrible. I mean, you know, it's awful to have to travel.
Oh yeah, Hawaii.
Yeah, darn Hawaii.
It's like Ireland in January. Yeah.
Heck.
Anyway, that's exactly what I do there. I've redesigned their cocktail lounge and I recreated their menus, and I'm working my way through the whole service staff. in spirit training and cocktail training. And yeah, I do that here locally. The folks who own Zoe have just opened Jovia, a wonderful new restaurant on the Upper East Side, where I did exactly that for a week, trained their staff and helped design their cocktail menu. So, sure, I do a lot of it.
Now, what I think is very interesting is that when I call you on the phone, because everyone should know that Mark and Dale and I are friends, but, you know, I'll call you on the phone, you pick up your cell phone and say things like, I'm in Moscow training bartenders. What were you doing in Russia?
I was invited by the Russian Bartenders Guild. Actually, I had met some of these guys in competition in Spain and different places, and they have a fledgling cocktail program happening in Russia. Russia sort of missed out on the whole thing, because if you think back about the history of Russia, when the revolution came, you went from basically a medieval czarist society to a sort of modern society, started up more agrarian but ended up more industrial. Vodka was outlawed the second the revolution took place, and really didn't come back full strength as the vodka we know today until during the Stalinist regime.
And even then it wasn't mixed in cocktails.
No, they drank warm vodka and beer, and cocktails were considered decadent. And so really, until the Iron Curtain fell, there was no cocktail tradition at all in Russia. Mm-hmm. Now, like everywhere else in the world, it's extraordinary how this thing is spreading. There is in the 22 to 35 year old set, there's tremendous enthusiasm for this American invention called the cocktail. And there's I did seminars for 50 bartenders who's traveled from as far away as St. Petersburg in Ukraine, just to come to this seminar.
You know, people may not realize that the cocktail is an American invention, and, you know, we see a resurgence of real cocktails in America, but this isn't just a function of Sex and the City. Throughout the world, the American cocktail has a tremendous resurgence, and Dale is one of the foremost experts in the world on the cocktail and in demand around the world, and he talks to us from his home in Long Island today. Our guest is Dale DeGroff. He's the author of The Craft of the Cocktail, which you should pick up, and you can find out more about him on our website. We'll be talking more with him in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:25.
You're back with Mark and Francis on The Restaurant Guys. Today we're talking with Dale DeGroff, author of The Craft of the Cocktail and the preeminent bartender and expert on bartending in the United States.
And Dale, we were talking a little bit before the break, and we glossed over it, and I want to return to it, about the Museum of the American Cocktail, which you were instrumental in founding in the city of New Orleans about 9 months before the hurricane, and is now surviving, going to the Commander's Palace in Las Vegas, and you're going to open an exhibit in New York. What does one see when one visits the Museum of the American Cocktail?
The exhibit in New Orleans, as was curated by Ted Hay, was a timeline. You walk in the door and you're greeted by a huge blow-up of the 1806 article in the Balance and Columbian Repository, which defined the cocktail. If you look closer, you'll see the letter to the editor, which spawned that response. So the whole is documented, photographed from the original paper. So that's a bit of history that everybody is fascinated by right there.
Uh-huh.
And then you begin to walk through a history of how the whole thing evolved, based on objects from all of our different collections, as well as placards that describe different important moments in the cocktail. For example, the artificial ice machine, which really made the modern cocktail bar possible. And all the other technological advances, like being able to saturate water with gas, important. Being able to push beer through lines with gas. So you see some of the technological evolution, and you also see the evolution of the product itself, how the martini went from a five-ingredient sweet drink to a two-ingredient dry drink over a period of 100 years, you know.
One of the most interesting things that I ever experienced with you was you did a cocktail dinner, I think it was at the Rainbow Room many years ago, and there was a gentleman there who had this amazing collection of cocktail shakers, which you know, it sounds kind of silly, but they were such beautiful pieces. They were beautiful pieces of craft, approaching art. Do you have those sorts of things at the museum?
Tons of them. We've gotten, that gentleman was Steve Visicke, and he really did have and still continues to have a huge collection. He sold part of it at Christie's and auction, but... he still has a large collection. And the people he sold it to are actually fellow collectors. We call them the Gang of Four. They're four extraordinary people who have wonderful collections, and they're all exhibited at our museum. And these things
really are. I mean, you see, well, what would I go to a museum to see?
They're a piece of history. There's no question.
Well, they're also beautiful.
Mm-hmm. They're made out of silver and glass, and some of them are worth hundreds of thousands of dollars. I mean, there's one red glass slipper, you know.
You know, we're going to talk about the glass slipper more in just a moment with Dale DeGroff, author of The Craft of the Cocktail and America's preeminent bartender, talking with the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott, and I'm here with Mark Pascal. Together, we own Stage Left Restaurant in New Brunswick and soon-to-be Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in downtown New Brunswick. And we're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. Listen to us every day from 11 a.m. to noon. And you can reach us through our website at www.restaurantguysradio.com. Today, our guest is Dale DeGroff. He is the author of The Craft of the Cocktail. He is the founder of the Museum of the American Cocktail. And he is the preeminent American bartender, and that's no exaggeration. And no joke. Hey there, Dale.
Hey, Francis, Mark, hi.
You know, we were talking a couple of weeks ago, I met you for a cocktail, and we were talking about how the bar culture in New York...
Hold on one second. You don't meet Dale DeGroff for a cocktail ever, anywhere.
That may be your intention at the outset of the evening.
Yeah,
we were talking about the cocktail culture and bar culture in New York. Now, you... How has that changed over the years? You came to New York when?
1969.
And you embraced the bar culture immediately? And what was it like back then as opposed to now?
Well, there are certain things that I caught the tail end of, and other things hadn't even started yet. The sort of tail end of what we know now historically as Swing Street was still active. There were three clubs, the Half Note, Jimmy Ryan's, and Eddie Condon's, that were still open, and I basically lived in these places because I was a jazz fan. So that aspect of the bar business, which was really minimal food, jazz, and great jazz, and expensive drinks.
Uh-huh.
And the upside was that you were listening to Coleman Hawkins, Lester Young, Roy Eldridge, Billie Holiday. I mean, you know.
And you knew
you were paying for the music with the expensive
absolutely.
Cocktails.
Well, but this was where, you know, this was cocktail culture. This was the jazz age and the cocktail age. Well, it wasn't the jazz age.
It wasn't proper cocktail culture, because that happened at the Rainbow Room and the rooftop dining and dancing places that a lot of people couldn't afford to go to. This was down and dirty cafe society culture, if you will, because those clubs on Swing Street were storefronts.
Uh-huh.
And you heard the music from the street. You could stand on the street and enjoy the music. And they were lined up one next to the other, you know.
And you knew a lot of the musicians back then, right?
Yeah, I had met them in high school because my best friend's older brother was a jazz piano player and invited a lot of guests down from New York. As a matter of fact, one of my first nights in New York was walking into the Half Note, which was on Hudson Street in those days, when Hudson Street had no other commercial establishments.
Uh-huh.
When it was not Tribeca, but it was just an old industrial neighborhood.
It was just Hudson Street.
Yeah, and I walked into this old-fashioned jazz club. I say old-fashioned because in those days there was a band was on a shelf between the bar and the dining room, right behind the bartender's head.
Uh-huh.
And you walked in, I was facing the trumpet player, and it was Roy Eldridge, who I had met in New England, and next to me was the younger brother of the piano player. And so when Roy saw us at the door, he waved, and when the guy at the door stopped us and said, "I'm sorry, 21 or over only," because, you know, you could drink at 18 in those days, but Roy leaned over to the guy and said, "Those cats are with me." And that was my introduction to New York, "Those cats are with me." And I tell you, I couldn't top it, you know. That's when I fell and said, "This is home. This is where I'm going to live."
Dale, you were a cool cat from the beginning.
You know, it's funny. In cool cocktail places, very often I'll wind up at the other end of the velvet rope, and Dale will be on the inside, and he'll say, "That cat's with me," and I get in. So it's good.
It's an embrace that just I'll never forget. You know. Anyway, that disappeared, and what came in its place was sort of, I guess, the first of the new and interesting cocktail, the new cocktail society would have been Odeon.
Uh-huh.
And that style of bar where all the painters and gallery guys hung out down in what was then just the beginning of of Soho.
So this is the middle 70s, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And Soho evolved, you know, from a light industrial neighborhood to what it is today, and right along with it, that style of bar, which was sort of open, boisterous, bistro style, you know, kind of barroom style that Odeon represented. And you know, it evolved. We went through a sort of a techno period with bars like the Airport, and you know, they're done with you know, airport waiting room style decor.
I remember that.
I have a question for you. I don't like going to the bar at the airport.
Why would I go to it in Midtown? But here's something that I think is interesting. I mean, don't you think, Dale, that especially in New York culture, but in many cities, that the barman, being a gender-neutral term, the bartender, has a role in that culture, that the bar, because you're not just a drink maker, you know, you're a locus of community.
It's about one tenth of your job to be a great drink maker, and I'll never hire a bartender just because he can do that.
Right.
90% of your job is running that space in an ambient way, and knowing the best restaurant within 20 blocks, the best dance club, where you should go, what theater's playing, and what's hot, who won yet last night, who won the set, who's going to win tonight, who's playing, does this guy who's talking to this girl need to be talked to, or does she really want him to talk to her? Want him to talk to her, and this person who has no clue how to order a drink at the bar, how do we help her, you know? How do you take this guy who's had too much and in a nice way cut him off?
Mm-hmm.
How do you make this very unpleasant person a friend?
Yes. Right.
You know? This is what the job is all about, and it's a marvelous job, and you really can't do it unless you love that kind of stuff and have a bit of ham.
It's funny because Francis and I went out to a very nice bar recently, one that I actually like quite a bit, but the bartender was a little dry, and he had all the information, he had all the technique, and he made a delicious cocktail.
Goober.
But I really didn't want to talk to him at all. Let's get out of here and go someplace else where they make a great drink with somebody I can say hello to.
Well, imagine how much business you'd lose if the guy was also unfriendly.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, it's funny, Dale, because I have to say, Mark and I started in the business as bartenders, and my favorite job that I've ever had was being a bartender.
It's much more fun than being a restaurant owner. For anybody who's like, oh, I got to get into the restaurant business to own a restaurant, quit it. Go be a bartender.
You know, it's funny. All the bartenders out there thinking, I'm going to own my own place one day. I'm thinking, I'm going to sell this one day and have a bar at the shore.
The way Toby Ciccini does. He owns his own place and only works there two nights a week.
Who is this? Who is that?
Toby Ciccini. You know the guy who wrote the book Cosmopolitan?
Oh, yeah. Now, where is his place?
His place is called Passersby, and it's on West 13th Street, and you got to go there. You go on a Wednesday night because that's when he's there.
And he only works two nights a week. I like that. There was an old guy down the shore, down the shore, as you know, who used to own, he was an old guy, and we used to go into his bar, and he would make if you ordered a screwdriver, I mean, he didn't make any fancy cocktails, but he made a great Bloody Mary.
Mm.
And he opened the bar when he got up. You know, I mean, like when he came, the bar opened sometime between 1 and 4, you know? And
he had a hard night last night. He's not open until 3.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
Exactly.
But he would make a great, he'd make, like, you order a screwdriver, he would squeeze an orange, you know? And it was an old guy.
Back in the day when nobody was squeezing oranges.
And he was an old guy, so it would take, you know, a long time. He'd find the orange, he'd cut it in half, he'd put it in the juicer, you know, and the ice was melted by the time. But it was good. And he made these Bloody Marys that were to die for. So on Sundays, we'd venture to his place.
Lovely.
And what was amusing is if you didn't know the rules of the bar, you could really get yourself in trouble. Because if you'd said anything like, you know, this Bloody Mary is a little spicy. Can I get a little more tomato juice? His response was, he'd walk over, very nice, take your drink away, and say, get out of my bar.
Hey, listen, you know, that's something we neglected to say. Within the bar community in New York City, there's also that undying breed of bar like P.J. Clark's and all those other neighborhood bars, although P.J.'s has long gone beyond a neighborhood bar. And those bars still exist and will continue to exist. They are our living rooms, and they are where we go to watch our ball games and where we go to get out of our tiny little cubicles.
Uh-huh.
and enjoy life. And those are still and will continue to go strong in all five boroughs of Manhattan and every industrial city in the Northeast and all over the country.
Well, not even industrial cities. They're your local tavern, your
local
bar,
where
your friends are, and you know the bartender, and you know the person at the stool next to you.
We're going to talk in a moment with Dale DeGroff, the preeminent American bartender, and he's giving some seminars locally, and he's going to tell you where you can go and actually learn from the master himself, and we'll tell you some other places where you can go and have some cocktails and how to stock your bar at home. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with The Restaurant Guys.
Hi, hi, you're back with The Restaurant Guys, Mark Pascal and Francis Schott from Stage Left Restaurant in New Brunswick, New Jersey.
Where we have fun during commercial break.
And soon, I was chuckling a little bit. And soon, Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. Watch for it, everybody. We're not going to tell you when it opens because we're scared you're going to inundate us. But soon we'll open the doors if I don't jump out the window first. Our guest today is Dale DeGroff. He is the author of The Craft of the Cocktail, one of the best books on cocktails you can find. And we have a bunch at the restaurant if you want to stop by and pick one up, or you can go to our website and we'll link you to how to buy his book. He is no joke the preeminent American bartender. He travels all over the world teaching about the cocktails, and I would say that you are the godfather of the cocktail revolution. Wouldn't you think so, Dale?
Well,
I'll answer for you, Dale. You are.
My generation skipped the cocktail, so
I
might have been the only one in my generation to be interested in the cocktail, which is why everybody got so excited about it.
So what precipitated this, Dale? I mean, before you opened the Rainbow, before you were the opening bartender at the Rainbow Room, and Joe Baum restored it with lovingly to its former glory and brought the cocktail back to life, we were in the age of the
one glass bar.
The one glass bar and the no bitters behind the bar, mm-hmm. and you know, stuff out of a gun and stuff out of a bottle and Mr. T's Bloody Mary mix. And now cocktails, real cocktails from real ingredients, are all over. What happened?
Well, how did that come about? Prohibition brought that about,
No. What happened to end that and bring about the current?
What happened in the 70s and 80s that turned things around?
It really did, I think, begin with Joe. Joe did it in the culinary world. He brought us out of the steaks and chop restaurants of the 50s and the Cantonese and the Italo-American scene to where we are today. And if you don't believe that, look at the Zagat's Guide, which went from 13 ethnic cuisines to 98 in their last issue.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Joe, I think, who took us that route. And he didn't just do it with food. He did it with wine through Kevin Zraley.
Mm-hmm, sure.
Kevin went on to inspire young people all over the country.
Us.
Excellence, including Andrea Immer, who's become an extraordinary wine expert in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And he did it through me. I mean, he inspired me to go to a place I would have never gone.
And, you know, it's funny. We're talking about Joe Baum, who's one of the most important restaurateurs ever in America, and who brought Kevin Zraley, who's the preeminent wine educator in the world, and Dale DeGroff, who's the preeminent cocktail educator in the world. That's an amazing legacy.
All in one place. The collection of talent that came from the Rainbow Room is just extraordinary.
And it's not just that. It's people like Alice Waters. She freely admits that it was the Four Seasons that inspired her.
Wow.
Larry Forgione on American Place. Find your top American chefs in the last 25 years, and they're going to tell you that it was Joe Baum, or some Joe Baum operation, or a stint in his kitchen, or something that really brought them along.
Well, right. You know, one of the things that I really like is I was a wine guy, and Kevin Zraley taught me a lot many years ago and has been a great supporter ever since. He sent me all around the world. He gave me letters of introduction to everyone. He's an amazing guy. So I was a wine guy until I met you, Dale, and I thought, yeah, cocktails, whatever. And then you showed me the cocktails. You know, I was, you know, sat there with my mouth agape at how, you know, complex and interesting that cocktails can be. And I think that since then I've really embraced cocktails as a part of my life. A friend of mine, I'd be at home and mm-hmm. I'd make a pitcher of a cocktail or whatever. And, you know, not drink to excess. How does one incorporate cocktails into their lives home?
I think probably the last frontier, we're finally getting some decent cocktails in bars, although we did once a long time ago. And we have one, we have all along, but very few and far between. But it's starting to become more widespread. But in the home, I think, is the next sort of frontier, is to get people involved. And I'm doing seminars constantly, recreational seminars, and a lot more people are doing right. that. Chefs have been doing it for years. And I think people who have become used to cooking in the home and watching chef programs will be the same people that will follow and
that begin making these
and
great
begin making and
cocktails
throwing your own interactive cocktail parties is what I want to call them, where each guest comes with a ingredients for a cocktail.
Nice.
And they make that cocktail for the group, you know.
Very nice. Cocktails, you know. Now cocktails are an important part of any great restaurant. That's what Francis and I believe. But at the but at home, people just don't have the ingredients. They don't have the basic things that they need to make cocktails. And I'm going to ask you, Dale, to just maybe give us a quick couple of ingredients, things that people need where they can graduate from kind of making average cocktails to making special cocktails.
Well, I think the most important thing is figure out what you and your friends who you socialize with like.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you're really a nut for an old-fashioned, a Manhattan, a margarita, whatever, and start basing your bar around what you like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so buy the best ingredients that you can afford to buy. Get yourself a decent Boston cocktail shaker. I say Boston cocktail shaker, it's a little harder to learn on, but once you grasp it, it's a lot more fun. And plus, you have the glass part that you can clink and make a wonderful Manhattan or a martini with. And get yourself a pitcher to make a pitcher of martinis, but a nice crystal glass pitcher with a long cocktail spoon so you can be sociable and make five at a time.
Love those long cocktails.
Oh, they're great. And those tall, thin martini
glass
pitchers.
Glass pitcher's amazing.
Awesome.
You really only need about four glasses. You need a decent all-purpose wine glass. You need a cocktail glass. You need a high ball, a low ball. And, you know, if you're nuts about, you know, whiskey, then maybe you want to have a little tasting glass or something.
Now, Dale, people are flying you first class to Russia to teach them about cocktails. If you live around here, they don't have to fly you first class anywhere, right? They can come and learn from the master himself. You'll be teaching some seminars around here recently, right?
I'm going to be at Macy's Degustibus on November 5th. You can call Macy's in Herald Square. You know, I think their number is 439-1714. That's in the 212 area. And that's a chef's program that they snuck me into.
Nice.
The ghost of this.
And to hear Dale speak and to watch him demonstrate how to make cocktails is truly revolutionary.
Well, you're going to make cocktails right along with me on that one. You can have your own set of tools, and we're all going to be making cocktails together.
Great.
That sounds. I've done that.
That's great.
That sounds like a blast.
It is, and it's the best way to learn. It's the best. You get a real feel, and to actually feel and participate in the process is.
Oh, it's a lot of fun. You get to share with because you share a set of cocktail tools, so you get to share with somebody. And it's actually began the beginning of a couple of really nice love affairs. I remember, as I recall from the Rainbow Windows of the World days.
Well, there are also affairs that were less than complete love affairs, but, you know, anything can happen over a cocktail. Hey, Dale, thanks for taking the time to talk with us today.
It was big fun. Thank you, Francis. Thank you, Mark. And
thanks,
I'm
Dale.
Happy to be there anytime.
We'll see you soon, I hope.
Okay.
Take care. That was Dale DeGroff. He's author of Craft of the Cocktail, which is an amazing book which you should pick up. You can go to our website and find out more information about Dale DeGroff, our recently revamped website. And you can go see Dale himself at Macy's in New York. Give them a call.
On November
5th. And to take a seminar with Dale. He's an amazing storyteller as well as a craftsman.
Really great to take a seminar with, too, because he really does pass his information along.
You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark Pascal and Francis Schott. Today, our great guest was Dale DeGroff, author of The Craft of the Cocktail, and really the person who started or restarted the cocktail revolution in the United States again, and really a great storyteller and good guy. But, Francis, a couple of years back, you and I did a cocktail class at Stage Left for about 20 people. For consumers. A very, very fun little class where you and I got behind the bar of our own place and taught a cocktail seminar to some of the people who were really interested in it. And
I remember the beginning
of
that evening. No, that's not really true. It was fun. You know, Mark and I started as bartenders, and we, when we were bartenders, were not as good as the bartenders are today, as our bartenders are today in making the cocktails. I love being a center of community, part of community like that, but back in 92, we first met Dale DeGroff, and that's when we opened the restaurant. And so DeGroff helped us put our first cocktail menu together.
And we were talking about this earlier, how much fun it is to be a bartender and how that is definitely the most fun job I've ever had in my life.
And what happened when we did this cocktail seminar many years ago was Mark and I, because we'd started as a bartender, we have a lot of regular customers and friends who remember us as the young bartenders who really got a kick out of coming back and seeing us behind the bar again.
We started behind the bar in our own place.
We don't fit so well behind the bar together anymore. It's hard to get two people back there.
Yeah, that's a fact.
But the interesting thing, if you have a restaurant out there, to look into cocktails, and you need to look at it very carefully because it's not appropriate for every place. And some places that only have a service bar have a very small bar. Maybe it's not the best idea for you as a restaurateur to have an active cocktail program, but you should have a couple of well-chosen cocktails no matter what. Now, you need a somewhat bigger place, which is why Catherine Lombardi, the restaurant we're about to open, is going to have a very significant cocktail program.
Yeah.
But when we talk about what it takes to have a real cocktail program today, we're talking about fresh juices, no roses, lime juice. Sour mix is something that you make with lemon, lime, sugar.
Sour mix is
sometimes
is,
egg whites. You know, it's not from a can. It's not from a jar. It's not from a bottle. There's no room for any of that. If you want to have a claim to have a serious cocktail program, and you know, it doesn't mean having 97 different kinds of chocolate martini and, you know, there are ingredients out there like apple pucker
and raspberry
schnapps, and that's not it.
That's Francis and I aren't just talking about the mixers. We're also talking about the liquors that go into some of these things.
Real stuff.
And what I want you to use when you're making an apple martini is apple juice.
Or Calvados, which is a real apple brandy.
And I don't want you to use apple pucker.
It's made up.
And the apple pucker people are going to be mad at me, but... But that's not the ingredient that goes in it.
But
in
they can talk anyway because they're talking like that.
That was easily your worst joke in the history of this program.
Okay. But here's the deal, everybody.
What you guys missed was Francis actually squeezing his face puckering. And puckering.
Well, the thing about it is. The rules for cocktails and flavors is the same as the rule for wine and the same as the rule for food. And even the great bartenders today are calling themselves bar chefs. Mm-hmm. It's because you use real ingredients. It is okay for a cocktail to taste like water or cherry, like watermelon or cherry. It is not okay for a cocktail to taste like a watermelon
Jolly Rancher
or a cherry Jolly Rancher.
And when you're buying alcohols for your cocktails, don't buy the cheapest. You don't necessarily need to buy the one with the tiny minuscule characteristics that's the most expensive. But you shouldn't also be buying the cheapest.
We're going to go have a martini for lunch. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. This is Francis Schott.
And Mark Pascal.
Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.